From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Tuesday, May the 26th, 2020. I hope everyone had an excellent three-day weekend and got out and enjoyed some of this absolutely gorgeous weather we've been having, and we are back at it for another four-day work week this week, and we're going to be speaking first off this morning with Steve Pappas, editor of the Times Argus and Rutland Herald. In the second or latter part of this hour, maybe we'll see if Steve will go a little long, but if he needs to duck out, I was going to open the phone lines and invite listeners to call in with whatever's on your minds, and let me hear from you all out there. May have a couple questions for you. What do you like better, charcoal or propane for grilling? That would be one. Another one, the flyovers in honor of healthcare workers by the Vermont National Guard last Friday. Good idea or not so good? Those would be a couple questions we could all tackle in the perhaps a little later this hour in the program when we open the phone lines for general listener calls. In the second hour, we're going to, after hearing, I think, from one of our CBS News correspondents, we're going to be talking with Lauren Hurl and Joanna Miller of the Vermont Natural Resources Council. The legislature has reverted to its usual habits, as in March and April were devoted largely to COVID-19 emergency relief legislation and so on. And last week we were speaking both with the Speaker, Mitzi Johnson, and with Tim Ash, the President Pro Tem of the Vermont Senate, who were telling us that they were, as they had planned to do and hoped to do, getting back to sort of the normal legislative process. Among the items on the agenda this year had been something called the Global Warming Solutions Act. We'll talk a little bit about that, I do believe, with Joanna Miller of VNRC, and then Lauren Hurl will be joining us to talk about legislation that got cleared in the Senate last week on to reduce the amount of PFAS chemicals in our environment. So I'm sure a couple of interesting environmental conversations coming up in the second hour there people may want to keep it peeled for. All right, let's turn our attention right now to our guest Steve Pappas, who joins us. Steve is probably these days my most frequent regular visitor on the Dave Graham Show. I really appreciate his willingness to participate and share his insights on what's been going on in the state and the country. And good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Dave. I think that actually the flyover might be a good topic to start off with. I will offer an anecdote, if I might.
Okay, fire away. I mean, maybe that's the wrong terminology, but go ahead.
Take off, aim high.
Yeah, take off. There you go.
So in both the Rutland Herald and the Times Argus on Saturday, we paid, the flyover. It is newsworthy for various reasons, one of which was that it was, by its design, supposed to honor essential workers, especially healthcare workers around the state, but all essential workers. And then, conversely, there have been a number of people who feel that that is a huge waste of money, and that if the government really wants to be paying tribute to essential workers, especially healthcare workers, that they should be providing funding for protective equipment to keep those folks safe and get food to various people, and offer help in a more meaningful way rather than wasting hundreds of thousands of dollars in fuel. Long story short, we our lead art, because our photographers in both the Rutland area and central Vermont captured the jets flying over, and we put it on the front page, and the overline, the headline on top of a standalone photo, in that particular case, said high praise, and the number of comments and letters to the editor that we have received, basically condemning the newspaper for taking the position that this was a good thing, has been very surprising over the last 4 days. we actually haven't published letters to the editor yet because they're still trickling in, but we're going to have, I would say, a good 10 or 15 letters just on that topic of people saying, not only should you not have covered it, but you absolutely should not have put it on the front page, and you absolutely should not have suggested that it was a positive thing, even though the intention of it and the newsworthiness of it was still there. And I understand what people are saying, but we're not going to ignore news just because people don't agree that it's happening. But in both markets, the outcry has been loud. I mean, I would say shrill. Over the fact that this should not have happened and that we should not have been party to it. So,
wow.
It's been a very interesting conversation, but one that, points to, people all over the country. I mean, this is not just a debate that's happening here in Vermont, but the fact that people want the press, they want the press to tell them what they want to hear and see, not what
yeah.
they don't, you know?
And oh, yeah.
It's very unusual that, like I said, we can't ignore the fact that that happened, and people who didn't know what it was probably would wonder, why are there four jets flying at a high rate of speed, across the Vermont countryside? Well, we have an obligation, and if there's an opportunity there to know that we're going to catch it, we're going to do so. So anyway, I would throw it out there that I bet there's a fair number of your callers who do believe that this was wrong. Not the fact that I am never going to say that I was wrong in publishing those photos on the front page of either paper. But I am happy to have the discussion about whether or not that the flyover should have happened in the first place.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are two separate questions yeah. here. One is, should the flyover have happened? Is that the proper way to honor our healthcare workers in Vermont? And certainly, there was a lot of back and forth about that. As you've seen from your readers. The second question is, should the newspaper cover this what amounts to an unusual event in your backyard, which is four of the most expensive jets in the U.S. arsenal flying right over the local hospital in both of the communities where you publish. And folks, that's called news, okay? I mean, whether you like it or not, whether you approve of what the Vermont National Guard did or not, that is news. And news is sometimes something you like and sometimes something you don't like. But it's definitely the job of your local newspaper to cover the news. I mean, I'm surprised that anybody in this day and age has sort of missed that pretty basic lesson or message.
Well, a few weeks ago, there was a very, very small protest at the State House of individuals who did not feel that the state should be recommending or mandating, whatever you want to call it, wearing of mm-hmm. masks. And I mean, it was fewer than, I don't remember, I think it might have been six individuals who showed up. And Jeb Wallace Broder, who's an outstanding photographer for us, award-winning, took a picture, and it just so happened that the angle at which he took the picture of between the gentlemen who were protesting and the kind of people who were milling about, some of which were press, it looked like there was a bigger crowd there than there probably was, at least of protesters. Mm-hmm. And
yep.
we ran that on the front page to let people know that there was a counter point of view. Same kind of thing happened of the paper was, in the opinion section, was very much skewered by people feeling we had skewed the news and said and implied that this was an event that was bigger than it was. That was not our intention at all. Our intention was to point out that people who don't want to wear masks were having a protest in close proximity to one another in downtown Montpelier at the State House. And we cover demonstrations at the State House all the time, whether it's 10,000 people. I mean, we don't do all of them, but it's people protesting and having a say, first of all, it's their First Amendment right, is newsworthy often. And every year there are the pro-choice individuals who have a protest or a demonstration, celebration, whatever you want to call it, at the State House. And then there's the pro-life group that has a demonstration, protest, gathering, whatever you want to call it, at the State House.
Right.
And we cover both of those. And the other side gets angry that we do. Well, as you point out, lots of opinions on various issues. It's not up to the newspaper to necessarily say this is right or wrong. And the placement of these things on the front page is not necessarily an indictment one way or the other. It's just where things fall on any given news day. That's probably the most common question I have, is why did you feel like that needed to be on the front page? And
I'll tell you, Steve, my own editorial decision might differ on some days, and oftentimes it really has to do with what else is going on. What are the competing news items out there that we need to devote our attention and our limited column inches to? And one of the things about protests at the State House is, first of all, I remember reading years ago in a journalism course textbook these things described as media events. In other words, they are completely contrived by organizers merely to try to get coverage in the media. And so are they real? Are they grassroots? Are they actual, do they actually reflect any sizable portion of the population and their beliefs out there? Or are these things, organized, and maybe even the organizers paid by, specific interest groups or that kind of thing? That's one thing that might turn the needle against coverage. Another aspect of it is the sheer size. I mean, the Women's March on Montpelier, March 21st of 2017, or I'm sorry, January 21st, the day after President Trump was inaugurated, you could not miss that. That was tripled the size of our small capital in terms of the turnout, and it was basically a history making event there. That was a news event for sure. Mm-hmm. When 10 people, or fewer than 10, or whatever it was, show up at the State House to try to raise a ruckus or something, I, again, I'm not saying I wouldn't cover it automatically necessarily, but it moves the needle a little bit, don't you think?
It did, but 2 days before in Concord, New Hampshire, more than 200 people, some of them armed with long rifles and AR-15s, protested mm-hmm. outside the State House there, and there was no indication that the same thing wouldn't happen here. We did not send a reporter to that protest in Montpelier. I asked Jeb to swing by, and he caught a picture that ended up going on the front page, just saying, yep, this happened. Here's a moment of note. Now, the other thing to keep in mind is that that was a few weeks ago now. Jeb and our photographer at the Herald, John Olander, are the only two newspaper employees who are going out into the public on a regular basis. Our reporters are, for the most part, working from home or office, but they are doing so by telephone and email.
Right.
Jeb and John are actually putting themselves out into the public, and they may be the only two employees, actually, in our entire organization who you could say are putting themselves in harm's way. So for the most part, the photographs that you've been seeing in the paper have been scenics, nature, things that don't necessarily involve or things that can be shot from kind of a distance. Not in close proximity, and we're doing that on purpose. Those guys have pretty strict guidelines that I have imposed to make sure that they stay safe, because I would feel terrible if something happened and they contracted COVID.
Are they wearing masks when they're out there?
I believe they are. I know that the photographer down at the Rutland Herald is very concerned about it, so I expect that he definitely is. They're supposed to be. They're supposed to be following all of the guidelines, and actually, when they come back into the office, they also are supposed to be. wearing a mask. And, you know, we don't have a lot of people working in the offices, but there are a handful of individuals who are keeping the, serving as the ghosts in the machine and keeping things running.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I also wanted to get your help maybe sorting out a couple of, I don't know, value statements or propositions or whatever, that, and some of this some of this does go to the wearing of masks, and let's see here. Well, we have all sorts of ways in which we talk about honor and respect. I mean, certainly Memorial Day brings this to mind. The way we, you know, a lot of folks go to their local cemeteries and put flowers on graves or listen to someone play taps. And obviously there is a lot of solemnness about Memorial Day in terms of honoring the folks who, people have made the supreme sacrifice for their country. And this is all important stuff. Meanwhile, you know, you have that sort of honor that happens, and then and you imagine for a moment. I've never been in the military myself, but there's got to be a process in the morning when a soldier puts on his or her gear, or a police officer puts on his or her gear, including maybe a bulletproof vest and all the other stuff they have to wear, even on hot days, you know. And they're putting all this stuff on as part of their work in protecting other Americans. And by reputation, conservatives are better at honoring that work than liberals, right? Mm-hmm. And yet, it seems mostly conservatives right now who are unwilling themselves to put on a lightweight face mask. You know, you honor people who will put on a bulletproof vest when it's 95 degrees outside, and you can't put on a lightweight face mask. And I'm like, huh? That, something doesn't add up here. What do you think?
Well, I mean, it comes down to, I have some friends who refuse to wear face masks, and I have friends who are police officers. And the friends who are police officers are concerned about the people
yeah.
who are openly not wearing masks, and I, you know, it comes down to personal choice, and you know, it always comes down to that, right? So if you have the option of being able to say no, you're not going to do that, then there are groups out there who will not be told what they're going to do and how they're going to do it, whether it's carry a weapon or you know, have an abortion or whatever it happens to be. There are folks who are going to, they want to make that decision on their own. They do not want to be told what to do. And fundamentally, that's what this feels like it has come down to, is that no government, no agency, no organization is going to tell me how I am going to act outside of, you know, my home or in my home. And again, we've talked about this before on other shows, it is not the majority. It is, at least in Vermont. I think in some places there are even more, there's a higher percentage of the population that is resisting this. But the group that's been vocal here, as you say, it has been very conservative. It has come down to personal choice. Now, my friends who are police officers, some of whom are very conservative, and are huge advocates of Second Amendment and wanting to make sure that, you know, that all rights are protected. The two gentlemen I have spoken to have said, and I really wish people would wear their masks.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're a police officer, you obviously have a, I mean, there's a personal stake in that, not just the overall public safety, but you go out and you might have to encounter somebody closer than 6 feet, and it would be better if they had a mask on. So, anyway, hey, I want to get a listener on the line. Jim from Barrie is calling in. Good morning, Jim.
Guys. Hello. How are
Good
you
morning.
Guys?
Good. How are you
Good
doing?
Morning.
Hey,
yeah.
Well, I want you to know that when the Jets did the flyover, I live in the vicinity of the Berlin airport, and I was ready because I knew they were coming through, you know, during the noon hour at some point. And when I looked up and then saw the picture in the paper, Steve, I think my eye lens was on the same lens of your photographer, because that's what I saw. And I just want to say it was a thrill for me personally. And I don't know of any other salute, except maybe Governor Scott could take his race car and do burnouts around every hospital. that would probably get some grief, you know? And I want to say it was a great photo. And Jeb, longtime photographer for your organization, he plastered my face on a front page once, and we're friends. And I just want to say that, you know, conservatives, liberals, we all live in the same world, but that was a great salute. And you know what? I was thinking, if there was ever a vaccine for the virus and they needed some guy to go quick in a jet to get it, it'd be the Green Mountain Boys. Because those fly fast and they're powerful.
But let me ask you, Jim. Jim, let me ask you, just to play the devil's advocate or something here just for a moment.
Sure. Imagine
you say, you know, I mean, sometimes you honor somebody or show them appreciation or whatever by bringing them a bouquet of flowers or a box of candy or something, as opposed to flying a plane over their building. Imagine the Vermont National Guard, I don't know, took up a collection and bought a whole bunch of boxes of candy or bouquets of flowers and delivered them. Would that have been as effective, and would that have been, I don't know, less consumptive of fossil fuels?
Well, it may have caused a, you know, could cause a traffic jam, like the National Guard's handing out food. So if they did, deliver flowers in boxes of candy, you know, I'm sure people would show up. And I just think that we're all, you know, we are at a crisis now, and for people to be negative about something that our military's doing that, you know, protects us, is not the greatest thing in the world. And they probably flew over a lot of cemeteries with veterans in them, you know?
Okay, Jim, let me ask you this, just because we also kind of talked about our military a little bit in this other context this morning, and the police, and that is that they routinely don a lot of gear to protect other people, right? And it's part of their work, you know. Police, I mean, you know, you're protecting yourself too when you put on something like a bulletproof vest. But police officers, you know, basically walk around with a lot of other stuff now, even including cameras on their bodies, as part of their work. And you know, I would think something like a camera hanging off my shirt, you know, might bug me, especially if it's hot and humid out and kind of sticky and whatever. And then you add to that all the stuff on the belt, you know, the handcuffs and the et cetera, you know. Well, I guess my question is, so these people say, you know, and I'm sure when they get dressed in the morning and they're putting all this stuff on, you know, it's part of a ritual that is all about protecting American citizens. You know, at least that's at the very center of their concern. It says on the side of a lot of the cars, to protect and serve. Okay, so now to protect other people, the general citizens are being asked to wear this little lightweight cloth over their nose and mouth when they go out to a store or something. And a lot of people are saying, well, I'm not going to do that. I have the right not to do that, and I have the freedom not to do that. I better not do that, and I'm not going to do that. And I just wonder, you know, how do you honor the people who put on really heavy, serious gear every day when you can't put on a little face mask?
Well, you know, I do honor the police, and they're great public servants. And those bulletproof vests, I mean, that's hot to begin with.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a requirement, and they have the body cams. And so
I'm always amazed. I see these guys walking down the street, and they got all sorts of stuff hanging off of them. And I go, man, you know, I think to myself, I got to carry a cell phone and a couple of pens and a notebook when I'm a reporter, and sometimes that's a pain in the neck. But it's nothing like what a police officer typically deals with.
Yeah, and, you know, it's about the world we're living in at the moment, and who knows the future at this point. Police officers are great servants, and my interactions with them in my adult life have been all positive. And, you know, take the guys in the jets that flew over, getting back to that. Mm-hmm. They weren't wearing face masks. I mean, they were outfitted with heavy equipment, you know?
And those guys, they used to wear oxygen masks back in the day, you know? So
if at any point, if they have to eject, they have to have a parachute, you know?
Yeah. So there's a lot of gear there, too.
Yeah, people protect us. And, you know, this is where I'm coming from, and thanks for the conversation.
All right. Thank you, Jim. Good talking with you. Steve Pappas, you know, I mean, this is what is somewhat ironic to me, though. I mean, and I just want to see if you agree or think I'm crazy, you know, if we want to honor... If we want to pause and think about what police officers and military people go through every day and just in terms of the gear they have to wear, do you think that would be a reasonable thing for people to do, is to say, hey, if it's about protecting other Americans, I can wear a face mask?
Well, I see the irony of it. I would say that there are a lot of issues that are like this where... you know, people are willing to do one thing, but they're not willing to do another that seems just as, you know, just as important.
Steve, we're about to go to a bottom of the hour break. You want to stay with us through the break? Can you do that?
Sure, I can stay with you.
All right, we do have a few seconds now. I just want to, I'm sorry I interrupted there. I should have waited a few, but you were in the middle of a sentence.
So I guess what I would say is that in this case, yes, it is reasonable, but... It is outweighed by the fact that it is a personal choice. They don't have to do it.
Yeah, it is. It's not a legal requirement as things currently stand, at least not in Vermont. Hey, we are going to go to that break. Let's go hear some CBS News, a couple words from our sponsors, and stay with us, folks. We'll continue the conversation on the other side.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Continuing our conversation with Steve Pappas, the editor of the Times Argus and Rutland Herald, and I did promise I would open the phone lines this half hour. Actually, they're always open, but really want to focus, if possible, on any calls that folks may have wanted to make in recent days, perhaps, and wanted to weigh in and just check in about other topics that have come up and recently here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. We like to be sort of I think there was a station in Boston years ago that used to talk about being a town meeting of the air, and I want to take a similar approach here, in which anybody who wants to get up and speak, and all you got to do is call 244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255. Those are the two numbers where you can reach the WDEV studio, where my stalwart friends, people like Dana Jewell and Lee Cattell, are on duty to take your call, patch it over to me. I'm still working from home. They've been in the studio throughout because, as Steve was saying about his operation, you got to have some ghosts in the machine to keep it all functioning, and those guys have been real stalwarts for WDEV. My friends Lee and Dana, and they keep showing up, and kudos to them for that. So anyway, I wanted to get back to Steve and just ask you. You had an editorial, I think, is probably the most loved thing you run in the paper in any given year in the Times Argus and the Rutland Herald this morning. It's lilac time.
Yeah, it's a tradition. It's obviously gone through at this point 9 owners of the newspaper since it was first written in 1929.
Wow.
And it is a tradition. It's one of those, yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus kind of versions of a.
That's right. That's the Christmas tradition
for Vermont.
Yeah, right.
And and it first appeared in the Rutland Herald, written by a gentleman by the name of William Field, it has become a kind of a Memorial Day tradition. One year I forgot to run it.
My word.
Yep. And it was not that long ago.
Must have been big trouble.
Well, it's kind of like taking the comics away or changing up the comics. There are certain people who look forward to it. It never changes. I mean, the intro to it changes. And, I note in the intro this year, it's great that we have traditions. It's great that we have these benchmarks by which we kind of measure every year. Honestly, it's great because it gives me a little relief. I didn't have to write a fresh editorial for Tuesday's edition. But the bottom line is people love it, and it's fun to dig it out and kind of give it a once over. It personally doesn't do much for me. I like lilacs, but there are people in the community who, like I said, they kind of measure their spring by when that appears. And the funny thing is that I published it today, and one of the first comments that I got from a reader in Rutland was, the lilacs have been blooming down here for about a week. You're late.
Well, if you're going to publish it on Memorial Day or as close there to as possible, Memorial Day is actually a little early this year, just because of the calendar. So you're going to be late some years. That's the way the botany works out there. So, hey, I want to go to a couple callers here. They're starting to pile up just a bit. Bill's on the line for Barry. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, gentlemen. First of all, I want to talk about both subjects. I'm going to make be brief about the mask. I'm a conservative, and I wear a mask out of respect for others. And the fact that you wear the mask when you go into a store because you don't want to get the virus and you don't want to give it to somebody. And that's, I respect that completely. Now, about the airplanes, I want to talk about that because I have a new thing. My father was a pilot in World War One. He was a fighter pilot in France. And in World War Two, he was in the Pentagon because of all the stuff he knew about planes. But, and one of the things he knew, and I know, is every minute that those guys fly, they are training. The money is not being wasted. They are training. They're new planes, and those pilots have to learn those planes. And the more hours you've got, and this I knew from my father, the more hours you put in, the better pilot you are in that new plane. So they weren't wasting that money. And I was there in front of, I was in front of 802 Toyota, and I went across the street to get it. And I've got to give Jeb Broder kudos. He got a great picture. I had a camera, but his pictures were really great compared to mine. I was thrilled, and there was a mob scene. The people came out of the hospital to look. The people came out of 802 to look, and that Kohl's parking lot was jammed full. And those people went there to honor not only the pilots and the people that worked in the, and also the people that worked in the hospital. So it was a great event. I was thrilled, and it didn't waste money because the pilots were being trained the whole time.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Bill. Appreciate it. Let's go to Jim in South Hero. Good morning, Jim.
Hey, good morning. I really enjoy the show. I've always have. So I just want to comment on the planes, the jets. I was thrilled. I was thrilled when I saw F-16s. I remember when we had the F-4 Phantoms. I was thrilled whenever I saw them fly over. I used to work in the defense industry, my first job, and you know, I've been on a nuclear submarine, not cruising, but I've been on it. They're fascinating. You know, our military gives more than, you know, as much or more than any segment of our population, and they deserve all the respect and honor that they earn. That said, at $980 million a copy, I think that's what those F-35s are going for, and I believe the whole program is $1.5 trillion. Boy, I'll tell you what. I really think we need to rethink where we're spending our money, because those planes are not doing anything to defend us against this COVID virus. And the nuclear submarines that we're building and the nuclear aircraft carriers and all that, I completely understand the need for some level of that defense, but there is no enemy, no foe against which we need an F-35. Russia is not going to attack us. China is not going to attack us. Those are the only two other countries that could pose a threat. Our economies are so intertwined that they would be foolish, and they know it. So what do? We have proxy wars. We don't need F-35s for our proxy wars.
Let me give you a little pushback here, Jim, and ask you, do you think one of the reasons that Russia won't attack is, and China won't attack, if in fact they won't, and I certainly hope you are correct about that, perhaps one of the reasons they won't is because they know we've got a very powerful military apparatus that would respond in kind, and that perhaps the F-35s would play a role there, and so... maybe the F-35s serve a deterrent purpose. Is that any? I mean, I've heard that argument. What do you think about it?
Well, you know, we need deterrent, absolutely. You know, whenever we have let our guard down against enemies, they have risen up, right? And mm-hmm. we absolutely need deterrent. But you know, these pandemics, pandemic has done more harm to our world than World War II did. But as much, I shouldn't say that, because I think there were 75 million people killed in World War II. So, you know, it's hard to, but as much as World War II, this is devastated through actual infection and death and the impact on our economy, as much as anything since World War II, you know, if we continue to have to physically distance here, our economy is not going to recover. I mean, this is devastating. So what more of a threat do we have than something like this pandemic? And do we really need to rethink our defense spending? We do, because battling pandemics is as much of defense as battling Russia or China. I think we're seeing that, right? I you know.
Yeah, I get you. And certainly the balance between the two, you know, perhaps needs to be recalibrated. You know, when hospitals don't have enough PPE for their staffs to respond to a pandemic, or if we have a shortage of things like ventilators, in other words, basically not enough medical equipment out there to respond in a crisis, as this COVID-19 showed in many places, you know, maybe there is a shift in funding priorities that would be in order. Certainly, something worthy of discussing. Steve Pappas, what do you think about all this? I mean, is this making sense to you?
There's a lot of different things to unthread here. I guess I'm a little leery to suggest or agree that I mean, we went from F-16s to F-35s to proxy wars and kind of came back around. I think that the pandemic has certainly raised awareness about various priorities that we have, both in our personal lives and what different groups feel need to be the priorities for our country. Commerce being a very big one, and I don't disagree that the recovery is going to be very long and very hard after this is over. I don't necessarily subscribe to the point of view that that all of this, that there are kind of pieces of this that are very that the pandemic can be used for political purposes of leveraging positions in the world. It's a pandemic. It doesn't understand borders. How people use it, for sure, can be leveraged. But I don't. I'm not feeling like. I feel like we just poured a whole bunch of issues into one bucket in that conversation, and there's really no way to come out of it logically. I mean, I guess it's the only way I can say. I feel like.
You know, well, isn't the federal budget one bucket in the final analysis? So you could say I want to say.
Well, that's what I mean about priorities, though. That's what I mean mm-hmm. about priorities. Is we can say, okay, well, this means that you know, we need to beef up the military. This means that we need you know, more funding toward finding solutions for viruses. Again, that becomes part of a broader debate, and we're seeing that at a certain level, but I'm not seeing it as a kind of a discussion about, you know, how we're being influenced. I think our election is being influenced, you know, by lots of different groups and factors. I think that commerce is, you know, really kind of in a nosedive at the moment that obviously involves the federal government to help kind of get us back on our feet. And I don't think we know what the repercussions of that are going to be or how long it's going to take. And I don't know if that means that we have to scale back the military and the military funding so that we can help offset some of the pain that's happening elsewhere in the country. But the other thing I would point out is that the military has been quite pivotal in history in fighting various kinds, fighting using bacteria and other things in the war, and as both as a deterrent and as a weapon. The military is working on the same kinds of things that the health industry is working on, just, you know, for different purposes, I think. And that's just one of those things that I think people forget is that happening simultaneously.
Yeah, Jim, what were you going to say?
Yeah, thank you. And, you know, I thank you for distilling it down for me, because that's...
I don't know that I did.
Well, you kind of focused it on the spending on the military, right? I completely agree with you that the military has been pivotal in helping us in situations like this. And I'm not advocating cutting the defense budget. I'm advocating rethinking the defense budget, and I'm using the F-35 simply as a talking point, right? Mm-hmm. That I personally don't think, if we had $980 million or $1.5 trillion, I think that's what I read the whole program, if we had that money to combat or prepare us for this pandemic, I think the outcome would be significantly different. And
all right, Jim, I got to jump, but I appreciate the call. I think you make an interesting point, and don't be a stranger. Check in with us from time to time when you have things on your mind. Steve, you are proprietor of a newspaper, which today had a fascinating story on the front page. I must say, it was that history piece by Paul Heller, and it certainly was one of these things that you're sort of reading it, and you might say to yourself, "Why am I reading this?" But it was still fascinating. So, what the heck was it?
So Paul Heller is a local historian and writer. He writes about kind of interesting tidbits of events that have occurred over time, and he's basically compiled all of these writings that he does for us and puts them into collections. And some of them have, in the past, have been specifically about Barrie. Some have been specific to Montpelier. Some have been kind of about the outer areas. But he literally is someone who just gets topics and delves into them. And he wrote one that we published today, and it's about an incident in 1963 in which some Norwich students, cadets, essentially did a raid, a panty raid, on Vermont College when it was an all-female school, also owned by Norwich University at the time. And it led to an incident in which the police and fire department had to be called in. There was a fair amount of damage to the building because of fire hoses to kind of disperse the crowd. There was apparently some kind of an assault in which, not a sexual assault, but a physical assault that led to cadets being suspended and expelled. It ended up that the police department had multiple injuries. There were shots fired in the air. It kind of sounded like something out of, you know, there's even a reference to Animal House in there. And then the outcry from the community afterward was really interesting in that there was a fair amount of condemnation of, you know, this outdated prank, you know, that shouldn't even be happening. But then there was a fair amount of support for the students, for the cadets, and saying, you know, mm-hmm. you know, these things happen. And, you know, kind of the excuse of boys will be boys. Kind of a blemish on, in history for both, both for Norwich and for, the idea of a, it's something that has fortunately fallen by the wayside. And
I don't think in today's PC climate you're going to have too many panty raids on college campuses these days. That was kind of a thing nationally for a while. But
yep, and I guess there was a literal movement about it for a while as done as a prank. But we've actually had two or three people outraged that we ran the piece, saying that it didn't have a place in the paper. So,
boy, nothing has a place in the paper anymore. Apparently, you're supposed to run blank pages. I don't know. I thought it was interesting.
I was editing that one. Yeah. What's that?
I thought it was interesting.
When I was editing it, that there were going to people who were going to be like, "Why are you even bringing this up?" You know. But yeah, it is interesting that. To me, it was more of an interesting kind of chronology of a prank going very bad. And
a slice of life from Vermont back in, life. You know, a little more than a half century ago now. Steve Pappas has been my guest very generously for this entire hour. I really appreciate it, Steve. Thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure.
All righty. We are fast approaching the top of the hour, which means we're going to go take a break for some CBS News upcoming. Afterward, we're going to be talking to one of our CBS News correspondents in a one-on-one conversation between them and WDEV. And then we're going to be focusing in on what's happening on some of the environmental legislation that was percolating along back in the early winter before the COVID-19 thing stopped everything in its tracks. Hey, folks, we'll be back in a couple of minutes. Stay with us now for more of the Dave Graham Show in the second hour on this Tuesday morning.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We're back, and as I mentioned, one of our CBS News correspondents, Bill Rakoff, joins us this morning. Bill, thank you so much for doing so.
Appreciate being here, Dave.
Sure, and fill us in on the latest on the coronavirus. Have we actually hit that 100,000 threshold yet?
Well, we're waiting to see the official numbers come out, but we're close. The last official number I saw yesterday was just north of 97,000. So any way you slice it, I mean, it's a milestone. You know, I think most people saw the New York Times cover this weekend that put it into, you know, amazing perspective, the number of people that have died. You know, and you know, take your beliefs about what you think about the virus and the response to it and whether it's a danger or not. 100,000 is a pretty significant number, you know, just on the face of it when you think about the number of people that were lost. And people will say, well, it's not fair to compare it to the flu or maybe to compare it to other, you know, tragedies or the Vietnam War or anything like that. But that may or may not be true depending on your perspective. But no matter how you slice it, 100,000 is a huge number. The administration continuing their response. Dr. Deborah Birx says that, you know, they hope that they can get a vaccine in time for a, you know, potential second wave of this thing coming to perhaps later on this year or the winter. But, you know, I don't think anybody in an official capacity, Dave, is taking it lightly.
Yeah, that's for sure. But some people are. Apparently, we had that scene from the Lake of the Ozarks in Missouri, where it just looked like a pretty typical first of summer party going on there, with people crowding around each other in that swimming pool that had the little tables set up for drinks. And I mean, you know, looked like kind of a fun time in normal times, but these are not normal times.
No, they aren't normal times. And I actually went to Ocean City, Maryland this weekend on Saturday with my son. And because we wanted to get a little breath of fresh air, and we were prepared. I mean, I'm a first responder as well. I've been an EMT and a firefighter. And so, you know, you take these things in stride. And when we got there, we found plenty of social distancing on the beach. Everybody was very spread out, at least by 50 feet or more, and it was a small crowd. We got down to the boardwalk a little more crowded, but not to a point where we felt unsafe. But yes, in other places, there were people just thronging in, and you know, just this is the worst fear of authorities rushing back too soon. And they knew this was going to happen, Dave, because, you know, you get a holiday weekend, it's summertime, and everybody's got cabin fever. There's such a desire to get back to normal that, you know, people are, you know, perhaps more willing to take risks.
Yeah, I must say, in terms of the mask wearing or lack of mask wearing, I was asking folks in the first hour of the program this morning, just, you know, Vermonters here, this question, and actually I want to put it to you, because I didn't know you were a first responder and a firefighter, but I think it might actually fit that biography to some extent. And it goes like this. You know, a lot of Americans pause to honor occasionally, as we did yesterday, our military people, or we pause to honor our police officers when one of them is killed in the line of duty, or more than one of them, and firefighters, certainly after 9/11. These folks put on a ton of gear every day, everything from bulletproof vests to, you know, all sorts of other security stuff, et cetera, all in the name of protecting other Americans. And do you think that one way to honor that would be to maybe put on a little lightweight mask over your nose and mouth?
Well, I mean, if you buy what, you know, everybody is selling from Dr. Birx on down, the mask isn't to prevent you from getting something. It's to keep you from spreading what you might have without even knowing it to other people. And that's the reason that first responders wear that sort of stuff. It's because, and it's why surgeons wear the masks, you know, in an operating room. It's not so that they might not catch something from the patient they're operating on. It's because they don't want, you know, their fluids, their breath, or anything contaminating. So, I mean, in that spirit, sure. You know, maybe people should be wearing masks, you know, a little bit more than they are. I will tell you that they're not required outside in Maryland, but my son and I wore them the entire time we were down there at Ocean City over the weekend, and it was a little disappointing to see the number of people who weren't. And again, the law didn't require them, but you would have thought that in a crowded situation, more people would have.
Some people seem to be regarding not wearing them as to some kind of a political statement. What do you make of that? Is that really a worthwhile way to make a political statement?
Well, you know, I live in the world of politics. It's what I cover day in and day out, so I'm not surprised by the fact that it is politicized. And, you know, it can't be helped, really. I mean, because these folks down here in D.C. don't know any other way. You know, in terms of, I don't think, Dave, that it ought to be a political thing. I think it ought to be a common sense thing. But I do think that people ought to be allowed to use their common sense and use their reason. What disappoints me sometimes is when I look around and it doesn't seem that people are doing that.
All right. Well, Bill Rakoff, I thank you very much for joining me today. It's always good talking with you.
Same to you, Dave. Thank you.
All right. Hey, and I just got an email from a listener out there, it says, I sent this message out to public officials around the state last week, and I thought I would give you a heads up in case you want to incorporate it into the discussions you have with them regarding masks. It says, I am offering this communications tip regarding how you might motivate people to wear masks. It seems that most people still think it is better to protect them and that for any number of reasons, bravado, too much trouble, forgetful politics, etc. They're saying, you can't make me or I'm not worried about getting COVID. My suggestion is to get the message out that, quote, I am wearing this mask because I care about you. People are generally showing they truly want to do what they can to protect others. Why else would so many self-isolate for the last 2 months? The challenge is to make it clear that the mask is part of that continuum of doing all we can to protect others. This attitude change can start by getting more people to realize not wearing the mask indicates they are saying, my convenience is more important than your health. Once they understand this, I believe more people will accept mask wearing as a positive step that they can feel good about instead of a burden and imposition. And yeah, I see that, and I also kind of I see that and I raise that by saying that you know, again, I think that many people, this really is all about a spirit of protecting others, and that spirit is so part of the ethic that you see among many of our military personnel. You know, as I've mentioned previously, many of our police personnel, you know, the cars often say to protect and serve on the side. And the whole idea is that we want to be, you know, a force for helpfulness and good in our society and actually provide that protection for people. Now here's an opportunity for average Americans who may not be police officers and may not be in the military, but they can protect others by putting this little lightweight piece of cloth basically over their nose and mouth. And it just seems if you ever are feel the need to honor our military personnel and honor our police and firefighters, first responders, etc., it seems like one way to do that might be to emulate them just to the extent of being willing to wear this really lightweight piece of gear called a face mask. Anyway, let's take a call from Karen in Hardwick. Good morning, Karen.
On the planes, it's the first time I've gotten to see them. They're magnificent. And I was so glad that they're ours.
I don't mean to laugh. I just, that sort of, well, yeah, yeah. I'd much rather have low-flying planes over Vermont being ours than Russia's or somebody's.
Well,
yeah.
I'd like to see them once in a while. And I'm wondering if you could get maybe an editor from another paper once in a while. The Caledonian Record had a magnificent editorial. It was Thursday, May 14th, and it was in response to what Tim Ash said about the shortfall of $400 million. And this editor went item by item through all of the different departments and ended up showing that there's a good $2 billion in savings here. And he says, you're welcome, Senator. Thanks for asking. But it would be worth a read.
This is the May 14th Caledonian Record. I'll look for that.
Yeah, and have him on for a guest sometime.
That's a good thought, too. I need to expand my... I am always trying to expand my list of guests, and if folks want to make suggestions, you are more than welcome to offer them up.
Also, The Chronicle, Tina Starr, I think would be an excellent guest. Just for a change.
Yeah, okay.
We hear Mr. Pappas too much.
All right. Well, thank you, Karen. I think Steve does a great job when he's on here. He's also been a guest host on the program, so I'm defending Steve, Steve Pappas. But I also realize that sometimes people fall into habits, and maybe I need to bust out a little bit and start reaching out to some of our other. I'll also tell you one of the. Things that happens is that a lot of people are very busy, I don't mean that Steve Pappas isn't. He's running two newspapers, for heaven's sake. I oftentimes wonder how he can give us the time. Some folks are. You call them up and they say, "Oh, I can't spare the time," and so that's another. But I should try reaching out to the Caledonian Record and the Barton Chronicle, et cetera, to see about expanding my roster of journalists. I certainly don't mind.
Okay, thanks
trying
a lot.
Thanks for the call, bye. Karen. Yep, okay, yeah. In fact, I actually called someone from the Caledonian Record just the other day to see about coming on the program here, and did not catch the fish, shall we say. But there you go. That is one of the challenges of lining up radio guests. Some people say yes, and others say no, thanks. And I always say, don't be shy, folks. You know, if I call up, I tend to try to. You know, I'm grateful when people are willing to come on and share some of their thoughts and insights with our listening public out there. And certainly, it is a good turn they do for us and for the folks. We want to go back to a little bit of our legislative issues coverage. Certainly, this whole situation here has been kind of thrown us under, as so many other parts of our lives have been. This radio show just added to the list of thousands of things that have changed big time in recent months with the COVID-19 crisis. But we are starting, I think, to... You know, people are saying it's not going away. It's going to be with us for quite a while. I heard one physician on television last night estimating that, estimating that there was going to be, this is going to be with us for like 3 years or something. So, yikes. And I hope that it's a less time than that, but, I guess we have to be ready for whatever happens. But I think one of the things that'll happen over time is that people will start to realize that there are parts of our lives that kind of need to continue outside of all this concern about the pandemic. And one of the things that I think is just starting to get revved up again is regular legislative business to an extent here in Montpelier, and among the items the legislature was working on before the pandemic hit were a couple of environmental-related bills, and they apparently are getting some new life. We're going to talk about those in the next little bit with a couple of folks from the Vermont Natural Resources Council, Vermont's, I think, maybe longest-standing locally grown environmental group. Started in the early 1960s, I believe, and with us from there today is Johanna Miller, and she's now getting to be a real veteran with VNRC, as well as Lauren Hurl, and the two of them are going to talk to us about some upcoming legislation. Now, let me just make sure, first off, Johanna Miller, do I have that right? Did the VNRC start back in the early 60s, was it?
Yes, good morning, Dave. 1963.
Wow, yep. Okay. And that was a big environmental year. Of course, that was the year of publication of a famous book by Rachel Carson called Silent Spring, having to do with what was happening with the applications of DDT and other pesticides around the countryside. That really, I would say, in some respects, jump-started the environmental movement. And its next big maybe punctuation mark was the first Earth Day, right, 1970, and the creation of the EPA under a Republican president, Richard Nixon. Here we are a half century later and still chugging along with folks who are out there trying to improve our environment, improve and protect our environment. And Lauren Hurl, you are... refresh me on the organizational affiliation here, because are you still not just with VNRC, or what's your deal these days?
Yeah, so I'm the executive director of Vermont Conservation Voters, mm-hmm. who effectively serves as a political arm. So we do advocacy for environmental laws, but we also endorse candidates and try to help elect pro-environment candidates. And we have a strategic partnership with the Vermont Natural Resources Council, so we share office space and kind of share some staffing, but are two distinct organizations with different missions and roles in the environmental community.
I see. Okay. So just wanted to get all that clarified. So anyway, I think I was going to start with Johanna this morning and ask you to describe a little bit to us the Global Warming Solutions Act. I think what we're going to do, ask you first for, is sort of a maybe a recap, refresher, or whatever. It's been a while since we were in class, and we need a little review. What the heck is the Global Warming Solutions Act? And then we'll get to sort of where it stands in the legislative mix here. Talk to us about that for a bit.
So the Global Warming Solutions Act is a bill that would turn Vermont's longstanding greenhouse gas emission reduction goals into requirements. We've had goals on the books to reduce our climate pollution since the mid-2000s, and instead of reducing our emissions, they have continued to grow until last year, when it appears that they turned a little bit of a corner with a slight dip. But the long and short of it is, we have a collective commitment rhetorically to doing our part to combat another crisis, the climate crisis, which is of deep concern to many Vermonters, and also a potential huge economic job creation opportunity. And the Global Warming Solutions Act says we're going to get serious about it. We're going to hold ourselves accountable to specific milestones and reduction measures, just like most of our neighboring states have done. Even as of late, Maine last year and New York as well took steps to turn their climate goals into requirements, and that commitment, even through this crisis that we're all collectively dealing with, holds true. So I think this is a really important moment to be having this conversation, because actually the Global Warming Solutions Act is a potential really important framework, planning mechanism and tool to move out of this COVID-19 crisis into a more resilient Vermont with a resilient recovery. So a bill that says we're serious about our goals and we're going to be strategic about how we meet them.
And talk to me a little bit about, I seem to remember, you know, discussions about Vermont's goals up to now, the way they've operated and the way they've been implemented or not. And one of the issues there has been, was described to me one time in the last few months, I think, by someone as kind of the lack of a stick, as in, so Vermont doesn't meet its goals, and what happens? You know, I mean, there's no consequence, really. This bill would actually set up some consequences, right?
It would, but hopefully we never have to get there, because, I mean, we actually have a deep commitment. This is not a partisan issue. We have a legislature that's supportive of attaining these goals. We have a governor who has said that we're still into the Paris Climate Accord and that we're going to do our part as a state to reduce our climate pollution. But this bill would, yes, set specific reduction requirement targets and timelines in place, the first of which would be by 2025 in accordance with the U.S. committed to in the Climate Alliance, and that sets some other shorter term, and then a 2050 reduction goal. But, you know,
what happens if we don't make these goals? Yeah, what happens if we don't get to these goals?
If you don't get to these goals, there would
yep.
be an opportunity to bring suit, take your, gripes to court, and the court could require the state to put plans and rules in place to ensure we attain the goals. But I just want to step back and say,
yep.
The state of Vermont imports 100% of the fossil fuels that we collectively use, most of us to heat our homes and get where we need to go in the transportation sector. That's a massive economic drain on our economy. Simultaneously, at least until recently, we've really focused on job growth in the clean energy sector and the clean energy economy, and this is an opportunity to continue to do that, rebuild out of this crisis into a more clean, green, local economy. And so it's a real important opportunity. So ideally, there is never a stick. There is never a need to bring a lawsuit. That's the worst case scenario. We have an opportunity to move out of this crisis into a better case scenario that would do well by all Vermonters.
And talk to me a little bit about statistically going to be a big dip when it's recorded and announced for 2020 in greenhouse gas emissions in Vermont largely because of the COVID-19 and basically people staying home, not driving around much. Is that already showing up? Have people actually recorded what that is?
I mean, Vermont, I don't know if Vermont's calculated its numbers yet, but globally, yes, collectively they are seeing a global reduction in greenhouse gas emissions and greenhouse gas pollution. But let's not construe what we need to do with the kind of economic and social upheaval that this pandemic is creating for people. We don't have to suffer the way this pandemic is causing people to do what we need to do in terms of climate. But one small silver lining beyond more quality time with family and friends and slowing down, that sort of thing, is, yes, our collective baseline has been reduced at this moment. So now we have an opportunity to pivot into a more local, clean economy and an equitable plan of action.
Okay. Johanna Miller of the VNRC, Lauren Hurl of VNRC, Vermont Conservation Voters. We are going to be continuing our conversation on the other side of a break. We're going to be pausing for some CBS News and a couple words from our sponsors. And when we come back, we'll pick up where we've so far gotten to, which is the big reductions we've seen, COVID-19 and air pollution. Back shortly, folks.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge. Countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
My guests are Johanna Miller of the Vermont Natural Resources Council and Lauren Hurl of the Vermont Conservation Voters. And Johanna, I want to continue with you just for a moment. And just for a moment on this COVID-19 air pollution reduction that we have seen. I understand your messaging there, and actually it's kind of interesting to me that you want, it seems, to make a point that folks should not associate reductions in pollution that we've seen under COVID-19 with, frankly, all the suffering and economic downturn and et cetera, all the downsides of, but what you want to save is you want to save the silver lining going forward, I guess. And would one of the ways that could happen basically be to set up some kind of campaign to urge that that folks, to the extent possible, continue working from home?
I mean, I think that
skip the commute.
One of the tools in our toolbox. I think we need a whole contingent of strategies, and I think the benefits of telecommuting in terms of reducing commute time and, reducing the amount of, sort of peeling back on the transportation sector, which is our most carbon-intensive sector in the state of Vermont. I think that's, again, one of the tools in the toolbox, but one of the things that I would say in terms of, we were talking about the Global Warming Solutions Act, which is, now, again, in the mix, bringing that back into the conversation. We currently lack a strategic plan and a sort of comprehensive way of looking at how we're going to do our part related to climate change. And the Global Warming Solutions Act offers I think, opportunity to develop a blueprint for moving out of the COVID-19 crisis into a more resilient recovery. I think the COVID-19, the pandemic, has really exposed the dire consequence of failing to listen to science and to experts. And at this point, collectively, while most Vermonters agree that, global warming is real and that we need to do something about it or risk severe consequences, we have yet to align that concern with the kind of steps that we need to take to actually do our part. And so we need a comprehensive strategic planning process that will enable that. The Global Warming Solutions Act sets up that kind of framework, looking at the opportunity for reducing emissions, but also in a way that sort of makes use of Vermont's unique assets, our natural, our really rich and valuable natural resources, our farms, our farmland, amazing, rich entrepreneurial agricultural economy, and all the people who partner in that, the role of our forests and sequestration and otherwise. And it really looks at the need to ensure that the steps that we take as a state to do our part on climate, create jobs and put people to work, but also really think about how we protect and prioritize vulnerable Vermonters, many of whom are suffering in this moment. So I think we have a real opportunity to pivot out of this pandemic into a transformative, more local, more resilient economy and way of living.
So the Global Warming Solutions Act is where in the legislative process right now?
Well, it passed the House in February on a tripartisan 105-37 vote, and then it moved into the Senate. It is currently in the Senate Natural Resources and Energy Committee. That's the Committee of Jurisdiction, And just last week, late last week, they began to hear, they got a walkthrough of the bill by the Legislative Council, and starting tomorrow, they will take the bill up again, beginning with testimony from the chair of the House Energy and Technology Committee, who shepherded that tripartisan vote of the House through. So their Senate Natural is looking at it right now.
Are you expecting or hoping for any significant changes in the Senate?
I just want to step back and say I have real gratitude for leadership in the state of Vermont, from the governor to legislative leadership, and to our lawmakers who have stood up in this crisis and really helped to, you know, serve Vermonters to make sure that they're being held whole as best as possible. But I think, you know, Zoom democracy and legislating in this moment is really tough. And so, you know, I think this is a really important bill that I hope gets a good analysis in the Senate, but that ultimately, you know, I think balancing how many changes with any bill would get with, like, moving it forward will be a delicate balancing act.
But I mean, do you think then that it would be better to leave it largely as passed by the House, or are there any specifics that you feel like it might, you know, improvements that VNRC is seeking, or are there things in there which I don't mean just additions, but maybe a subtraction or two?
You know, I think it's a really strong bill. I think, you know, I would love to see it move forward with very limited tweaks. We don't have any big concerns. This is a bill that, you know, there was months and months of work leading up to it through the leadership of House policymakers and an 80-plus member Climate Solutions Caucus who went on the road last fall and conferred with Vermonters, listening to them and hearing what they'd like to see. A lot of that input is reflected in this bill, again, which looks comprehensively at climate adaptation and mitigation strategies that, you know, are really unique to the state of Vermont and prioritize people, especially the most vulnerable. So I think it's a really strong bill. I think ideally it moves forward, and if, let's remember that the legislature next year can come back and make changes to it. If the bill doesn't pass the Senate this year and move to the governor's desk, we have to start over. So I would love to see this framework in place, that Vermont joins its neighbors. We're the only, you know, state in New England with rising greenhouse gas emissions. We're not meeting our targets like other states are. We have no accountability framework. This is a tool that we need in our toolbox. And if we have to come back and make strategic changes to it next year and in ensuing years so that we make sure it's the best framework possible, I think we should do that. At this moment, I think it's a really strong bill, and I really hope that the Senate passes it and the governor signs it.
Okay. One last thing, a little bit of a change of focus here just for a moment. I wanted to get your thoughts about something. A story I became aware of last week, maybe I should have been following a little more closely because I think it may have been even a little bit of time elapsed since it first broke as of then. But there was a settlement announced between Vermont Wind, the developer of the Big Sheffield Wind Power Project, and the and a neighboring property owner up there, in which, very unusual, in fact, I'm told for the first time, a renewable energy developer in Vermont expressed, quote-unquote, sincere regret as part of a stipulation that the Public Utility Commission, sincere regret over, you know, the impacts that this neighbor was said they were experiencing from the project, mainly noise. And I know that VNRC has been involved in issues of forest fragmentation, which is another issue that often gets raised by critics of Vermont's large mountaintop wind projects. And I'm just wondering, you know, where do you see this industry right now? Is it going to have a is it going to have a big role going forward in Vermont in the development of renewable energy and trying to mitigate climate change and so on? Or do you think it's pretty much stalled now? Where is wind in Vermont?
The wind in Vermont right now is pretty dead in the water, considering some of the planning frameworks in place, but more the noise rules that went into effect, which, you know, I think for us, the NRC has a very site-specific approach to any type of renewable energy development, because let's remember that most all development has impacts, and that there is no energy source out there that powers our lives and heats our homes and gets us where we need to go that doesn't have some consequences and costs. And how we manage that while we want to continue to keep the lights on and get where we want to go has to be really thoughtful. But I think that wind should and can play a part in our renewable energy future if we want to, you know, continue to, again, keep the lights on. I think there's huge promise in offshore wind. We're the state affiliate of the National Wildlife Federation. They are a leader partnering with, you know, states up and down the eastern seaboard in particular to look at well-sited offshore wind as a very cost-effective, clean, new renewable resource. So states are committing to massive offshore wind procurements that I think should and can be part of our part of the mix. And I think we should be looking at all options. And I think that, you know, talk to the people living in the shadows of, you know, the coal plants that are coming more and more offline about the consequences of the types of energy choices that we have made. I just think we want to think about things fairly and comprehensively and recognize that everything has the cost and the consequence, but local, in-state, well-sited, clean energy, renewable energy projects like solar, small-scale solar. We just bought a house a couple of years ago here in downtown Montpelier where I get to work near where I live, and we're about to put solar on our home. And I think there's more and more opportunity for that, and I feel good about helping to employ my fellow Vermonters, doing good for the planet, doing good for our economy, and I think doing our part when it comes to climate. So I just want to think broadly about how we're looking at all these issues and fairly, and again, just the Global Warming Solutions Act, I think, will be a really important tool, not toolbox, that really looks comprehensively at strategic climate action, especially moving out of this COVID-19.
But PFAS, obviously, very important issue. First really came to broad attention in the state of Vermont a couple of years ago when there was widespread pollution of PFOA, one of the members of the PFAS family, down in Bennington, and obviously has been a huge concern since then. Worries about possible appearances elsewhere in the state and generally a lot of it in our environment. What's the legislature doing about it?
Yeah, so the legislature has, you know, for years coming out of that discovery of the PFAS contamination of people's drinking water down in Bennington back in 2016, they've kind of taken a systematic look at what are the various ways that these chemicals are getting into environment, getting into our bodies, into our drinking water. And so they've passed a number of bills through the years trying to, you know, reduce the possible exposure. And this year they were really looking at how can we turn off the tap of bringing more of these harmful chemicals into the state to begin with, because what we've come to realize is PFAS are dubbed forever chemicals because they don't break down in the environment. So they're, you know, part of what has made them widely used are these amazing chemical properties like Teflon in your pan, where things just, you know, slide right off it, or waterproofing in your clothes, or various properties. And because of that, it's like this incredibly intense chemical bond that doesn't break down. So we know that if we bring chemicals into Vermont, that they're going to stay here indefinitely and then cause health problems for people. So
the legislature was looking at a bill, S-295, that was aiming to say, you know, what are some of the major places these chemicals are used in products, and can we get these chemicals out of them? Because they're not essential, they're just used for these, you know, grease-resistant or water-resistant properties. So that's what they were starting to look at this year.
And the current legislation, refresh me a little bit about it. What does it actually do about PFAS, and then we'll get into sort of where is it in the process?
Yeah. So it goes after a few of the major sources of PFAS coming into the state. So one area is firefighting foam. So these chemicals were added to foam to suppress especially fuel oil fires. What they've realized is this has become a major contamination issue. This is one of the major sources of water contamination across the country, because that chemical, you know, both in training or in putting out fires, it was sprayed all over the ground, seeped into water, and has, you know, resulted in a lot of water contamination. So, and they now have faced alternatives that are PFAS-free. So we worked with the Professional Firefighters of Vermont and provisions that would ban PFAS from firefighting foam. So that's one of the big ones. And a bunch of other states have actually already passed that. So Vermont would be just kind of putting in place similar protections as what a number of other states, including New Hampshire and New York in our area, have already passed. So it's one of the provisions. It also looks at PFAS in food packaging and restricts the use. So there's a lot of food packaging that doesn't have PFAS. Some does because of this grease-resistant property. So things like some pizza boxes have it, or your fast food wrapper, bakery packaging sometimes, like what you get your muffin in. Some of that really shiny packaging that's kind of slippery might have PFAS in it. Mm-hmm. Some does, some doesn't. So this would restrict the use of PFAS, and that's a major source of possible exposure for people, both. So, you know, you use the package when you eat your food, and you can be exposed that way. And then we throw all of this stuff away, and it goes to the landfill. And then the leachate of the landfill has PFAS. And then we're sending that leachate to, like, I'm on city council in Montpelier, and we've just recently learned that our wastewater treatment facility that takes some of that leachate now is putting PFAS into the river near us. So it becomes this huge issue. So it's firefighting foam, food packaging, and then carpets and rugs, which have it sometimes for stain-resistant properties. So they, you know, your stain master that you might spray onto your carpet, that has PFAS in it. And that actually is a major source of what's going into our landfill. When we get rid of those carpets and rugs, it's contributing a lot of PFAS, which then can get into our environment. And then the last piece is just looking at requiring reporting from manufacturers if they're putting PFAS in children's products. So our existing program that collects data from manufacturers to look at what harmful chemicals are being used in kids' products. So it would require reporting so we'd get a better sense of which of our kids' products might contain these chemicals.
Wow. Let me focus on carpets for a minute. I mean, you've imparted just now a lot of information, but but one of the things that popped into my head when you were talking about carpets and how it's, you know, PFAS from carpets is a major source of it in our landfills. A typical carpet, at least in our house, tends to be installed and maybe sit on a floor for, I don't know, 10 or 20 years or something, and then get disposed of. You know, finally wears out or whatever, and needs to be disposed of. So yeah, it's going to a landfill. I guess I'm a little surprised that over the course of our use of these carpets, there isn't some breakdown that occurs and sort of off-gassing or something like that. Is that persistent?
It is that persistent. So the Agency of Natural Resources here in Vermont just did a study earlier this year looking at, they were trying to get a handle on what were the major sources of the PFAS at the landfill. And so they had actually identified carpets and rugs as one of the biggest sources, which I think was surprising to some people. But yeah, I mean, it does both. So some of it we are exposed to. It can get into the dust and air in our homes. And it's been identified, particularly for young children who spend a lot of time rolling around on carpets and rugs. And as the mother of two small children, I can attest to that. So it's, you know, particularly, and children are most vulnerable to these chemicals, so it both can get into your house, but there's I think so much of it that it persists in the carpets and rugs too, that then get thrown away and cause, you know, downstream troubles too.
Hmm. Now this legislation, is it getting much opposition? I mean, are industry or other groups opposing it?
You know, compared to some bills dealing with toxic chemicals, it was, I would say, less vigorously opposed than they sometimes are. You know, again, some of these pieces, a lot of them have already, similar laws have passed in other states. So, you know, sometimes Vermont has been a leader on these issues and out front, and that's always, you know, could be a hard place to be. But in this one, we're in some ways just catching up to other states. We heard certainly from the chemical industry, brought in several witnesses to testify in opposition, you know, arguing that these chemicals are safe or we shouldn't be, you know, they're too important to restrict. But there was not a lot of local opposition to this. So it was interesting.
Yeah. And in terms of the environmental legislation more broadly that deals with chemical exposure and so on, are there any other bills pending this year in the legislative hopper relating to these kinds of things?
This is really the main one. We're kind of in implementation state. So last year, you might remember, there was a bill looking at lead in school and childcare drinking water, and there was a requirement to test all public drinking water supplies for PFAS. So there's a lot of work happening to implement those and look at, you know, okay, where are these, where is lead, where is PFAS in drinking water in particular, and then what do we do about it? So that's where a lot of the work is also happening, in addition to this PFAS in consumer products bill.
And just a minute or so to go, but broadly in the legislature, how is this year's weird schedule going to impact this stuff? I mean, are we expecting action soon, or I hear some of the budget deliberations might go into the fall, for instance.
Yeah,
this stuff too?
Yeah, so the Senate just passed this bill. So the committee had done all of their work, taking testimony and working through it. So it had been sitting on the calendar to be voted on by the full Senate. And just last week, they unanimously moved this piece of legislation through. So now it goes to the House, who has not yet even started working through this. So that's where the, you know, Zoom democracy will be. It'll be interesting to see how they can take up these issues and work through all the witnesses and the various perspectives and do their work on
pretty complicated stuff too. Yeah. So.
Yeah. So that's, you know, where we are, and we'll see how it goes. But it was great to see the just widespread support and you know, with a unanimous vote. Hopefully that gives some momentum to it.
All right. Well, Lauren Hurl and Johanna Miller of VNRC, and I should say of Vermont's Conservation Voters and VNRC, respectively. Thanks so much for joining me today, and thank you, listeners, for checking us out today. Do so again tomorrow, please. Stay tuned now for Bill Sayre Common Sense Radio, and that's it for today's edition of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. Have a great day, everybody.